affection and delight.
I can still remember exactly my first impression of Richard Burton. In the press profiles, he had always been called Stocky, and as his career declined, the journalists took to calling him Short. Later on, I realized that journalistic estimates of physical stature are always relative to perceived status, but I was still at the stage of believing what I read, so it was a shock to find that Burton was quite tall. What made him look less so was the size of his head. It was as big as a tea chest. You had to lean sideways to look past him. On the front of that vast expanse of cranium, the features were arranged like a caricature of Richard Burton. I was still getting used to the fact that the stars look so like themselves. It is the first, and sometimes the only, characteristic they have. An interview with Robert Mitchum went better, mainly because Mitchum was more interesting all round. There are people you can't take your ears off when they talk, even when they mumble. Mitchum was one of them. His mumble, however, was formidable. Operating through a spokesman, he demanded to audition us over lunch at the Dorchester. My producer Arthur Taylor and I were there early and well dug in. Mitchum turned up on time to the minute, but we couldn't understand what he was saying. "I seem fine scores rive Earl," he said. A trained simultaneous translator from Geneva would have told us that he had said, "I see my firing squad has arrived early." Theoretically, Mitchum was on the wagon at the time, but he must have taken one look at my beard and changed his mind, because when the waiter asked him if he would like something to drink, he made the waiter bend down and spent a long time whispering in his ear. The whispering was accompanied by illustrative movements of his hands, as if he were passing on arcane secrets in the art of flower arrangement. When the drink arrived, it was about 2 feet tall, changed color on the way up, and had foliage sprouting from the top, like a core sample from an Amazonian swamp. All it needed was a toucan perched on a branch. There was always the chance that this concoction had no alcohol in it, but it certainly had some kind of active ingredient, because after he had inhaled about half of it, Mitchum's voice suddenly came into focus. In studio, he was tremendous. His rare intelligence was in every sentence he spoke, and for a wonder, he spoke every sentence clearly, although he was still no louder than a mole in hiding. My next interview was with Burt Lancaster. After personally revolutionizing the Hollywood production system so that actors acquired real creative power for the first time, he had clung on too long to his status as the magnetic leading man, but he was still a huge name. He was in England filming a Michael Winner movie called Scorpio, so down we went to the location, in an open field where there were tents for dressing rooms, tents for offices, and tents for two different grades of dining hall, one for the dogs' bodies and the other, 100 yards further away, for the director and the star. The unit was between setups when we arrived. Sitting intensely in a canvas back folding chair marked Burt Lancaster, the star stuck a cigarette in his mouth and waited. He had to wait only a few seconds before Winner shouted, "A light for Mr. Lancaster!" A factotum bounded forward with a cigarette lighter already spouting flame. After the next shot, lunch was called. The smaller mess tent for the star was in plain sight, about 200 yards away. Lancaster stood up from his chair, but that was as far as he went by himself. He stared at Winner with a weary impatience. Winner took the cue and shouted, "A car for Mr. Lancaster!" A black Mercedes 600 loomed across the grass and stopped precisely so that the action hero could step directly into it after the back door had been opened by the assistant director, the PR attaché, and other members of the door-opening party. The Mercedes set off on its epic journey across 200 yards of grass, arriving at the sacred tent only a short time before the rest of us arrived on foot. Lancaster's door remained firmly closed until it was opened by the assistant director, the PR attaché, the other members of the door-opening party, and Winner himself. Winner congratulated Lancaster on his successful voyage in terms which would have embarrassed Lindbergh after his arrival in Paris. It was a graphic demonstration of the perennial need for the institution of monarchy, because there is a total, ineradicable potential for subservient ceremonial bullshit in the universe, and it all has to go somewhere. I would have been open-mouthed if my producer, Arthur Taylor, had not conveyed to me in a whisper the vital necessity of keeping my trap shut. I already knew that Lancaster had not attained his position as one of Hollywood's most powerfully creative figures by self-denial and humility. He had not only starred in more than his share of important movies, he had produced them and often developed them from the initial idea. To do all that, he had to get some respect, and had frequently got it by imposing his personality with the full force of his improbably gleaming teeth, sometimes implanting them in the outstretched neck of a courtier he found insufficiently supplicatory. But this stuff on the Scorpio location went beyond self-assertion. This was megalomania. Lancaster wasn't precisely carried into the tent, but its flaps were held aside by two men who had clearly learned their flap-holding skills at the court of Haile Selassie, and the business of making sure that Mr. Lancaster sat down safely would have been familiar to Louis XIV. As Lancaster, still in superb physical shape, lowered himself from the standing to the sitting position, Winner, from the other side of the table, flung out one hand in a gesture of caution, as if the star might be putting his life in peril from the speed of transition and change of altitude. You could see the instruction hovering on the director's lips. A parachute for Mr. Lancaster. In our preliminary conversation after lunch, Lancaster seemed to like my references to his early career as a gymnast. It is always a plus, when warming up a difficult subject, to get him or her talking about their formative skills. This gives them a chance to instruct you. I hadn't yet formulated this as a principle. I had got it right merely by luck. It was flattery, of course, a version of a light for Mr. Lancaster, but it worked. He scaled down the hauteur considerably. Instead of being Louis XIV, suddenly he was merely Napoleon Bonaparte. By the time our cameras rolled, he was practically mortal. The interview looked good on screen, but it made me wonder if I was really cut out for soothing the frailties of these fabled beasts. Did I really need the anxiety of talking to madhouse people with household names? The question was settled by my next interview with Peter Sellers. Universally acclaimed as a comic genius, Sellers, after Dr. Strangelove and A Shot in the Dark, was still on a high plinth, but the cracks were starting to show. Sellers had reached the dangerous state, for a comedian, of wanting to be cast as a romantic lead, as if he had more than comedy to offer. Successful comedy is already more than almost anything else, but there will always be comedians who regard their reputation for getting laughs as a cruel diminishment of their real qualities. It had become known that Sellers was one of these. It had also been attested that his famous range of mimicry included no character that could reliably be identified as Peter Sellers himself. He bought a new car every week, changed women every few months, and generally showed all the signs of someone short of an identity, trying to supply it with a sufficiency of fancy toys, ranging from the latest automatic camera to Princess Margaret. All of these things I had read about, but most of them I had discounted, on the assumption that he had attracted journalistic envy. But within minutes of meeting him, I realized that the press had been giving him an easy run. The encounter took place at some swish restaurant. Sellers and his latest agent were there before we arrived. While Sellers was regaling Arthur with a superb imitation of John Gielgud, the agent leaned in my direction and said, "He's a vegetarian this week." The implication was that the star didn't want even to smell meat. So Arthur and I ended up eating a small pile of vegetables each, while Sellers became Laurence Olivier, Ralph Richardson, Richard Burton, and Alec Guinness. In broad daylight, it was a jamboree of specters. He went on to become President Nixon, Bing Crosby, Winston Churchill, Adolf Hitler, and Marlene Dietrich. The only dud in the range was when he was pretending to be himself. His beautifully produced standard BBC English had the unmistakable gleam of a freshly forged banknote. But it was what he was actually saying that rang the alarm bells. He launched into an account of how Blake Edwards, the director of A Shot in the Dark, had screwed up the billiard room scene. As the well-modulated tirade went on, Arthur and I exchanged the glance shared by two coal miners when they hear water coming down the tunnel. I thought of A Shot in the Dark. Sellers had come up with the perfect face, voice, and set of movements for Inspector Clouseau, but he was everywhere abetted by well-planned scenes that could only have been the work of the writer and director, because they were the product of concentration, and Sellers was clearly incapable of concentrating on anything for 5 minutes, except, probably, on Sophia Loren in the passenger seat of his new Ferrari. I was wrong, however, to suppose that Sellers thought the world revolved around him. He thought the cosmos did too, and history, and the fates. After the endless lunch had ground to its conclusion, we headed off to the hotel in which our crew had taken over a room to rig the cameras and lights. The moment that Sellers saw which hotel it was, the really weird stuff started. He had drunk nothing during lunch except some special water that had to be brought in by courier from high in the Himalayas, where it had been strained through the loincloth of a swami, so he couldn't have been drunk. But suddenly he was staggered. "Oh no," he said. "Oh no. Can't go in there." It turned out that we had chanced on the very hotel where Sellers had begun his liaison with Britt Eklund. Their eternal alliance having ended with the usual bitter abruptness, bad karma had gathered around the doorway of the place where the universal catastrophe had begun under the guise of bliss. Evil spirits walked and groaned. Voodoo tom-toms, inaudible to us, pulsed. Negative feng shui enveloped the building. All of it, apparently, except the roof. When Arthur explained that there was no time left to hire another venue, agent asked client if there was any way of getting into the building that would not offend its incorporeal guardians. Blinking as if called upon to assent to the sacrifice of his immortal soul, Sellers whispered, "We could go in over the roof." It took 10 minutes to navigate upwards through the building next door, Sellers giving autographs all the way, with the terrible smile of the condemned. The interview itself could have been worse. Sellers decided to impersonate a normal, even reasonable, human being. In a position by now to realize that this was the most remarkable acting feat of his life, I managed, while the film magazines were being changed, to keep him occupied by proving myself familiar with his more off-trail achievements. He was not in the least surprised to encounter someone in possession of all this knowledge. Like every egomaniac, he behaved as if everybody else spent their day being as interested in him as he was. I had enough sense to mark this down as a lesson for life. Self-regard would get out of hand if it were given the power, so watch for the symptoms. Sanity would be hard to get back if it were ever let go of. Sellers had a conspicuous individual talent, but it was interpretive, not directly creative. He could never have emulated Chaplin or Jacques Tati and set up a whole project by himself, but there is no point carping. He had such a prodigious capacity that it would have been a miracle if he had been in full command of it. Those of us with less to offer earn no points for ordering our lives better. Wagner couldn't compose unless he was living in Byzantine luxury, worshipped as a living god. You and I aren't quite that nuts, but we didn't write Parsifal either.
For I am the master of the rebels, but call her up and cast her in the devils, and I am here for your instruction and delight.
North Face of Soho was abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. In Woman's Hour after the news, Jenny Murray will be learning to appreciate the culinary delights of goat. And then later this morning, after 14 years of brutal civil war, Liberia is embarking on a process of recovery. In an hour, Bill Law will report on the progress, or otherwise, in the first of a new series of Crossing Continents.
1 year on from a democratic election, this West African nation of 3 million is at a crossroads. Has Liberia bartered its future to multinational corporations prepared to exploit its rich natural resources and the people who work for them?
They do not want to know whether we suffer, we die. They do not have time for us.
I'm Bill Law in Liberia for Crossing Continents this morning at 11 a.m.
BBC Radio 4.